The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis Podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
Well, I am absolutely delighted to be joined today by Michael Apizi, an independent educator, entrepreneur and writer based in Tennessee. He's got a master's in cultural apologetics from Houston Christian University, where he wrote his thesis on Lewis's book, Till We Have Faces, under Dr. Michael Ward. We're going to be talking about this book, among many other things, as well as sharing some of the context for a paper that Michael presented recently at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. The title of Michael's paper there was Planetary Imagery Until We Have Faces. Michael, thank you so much for joining me today.
Pleasure to join you. Thank you for having me.
Michael, let's go right back to the beginning, because that's always a good place to start. How did you first come across C.S. Lewis?
Well, I remember being assigned to read one of maybe five books. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was one of them in middle school. And my dad suggested it, so naturally I picked another book. and later, I picked up God in the Dock off of my dad's shelf, thumbed through some of those essays, understood about half of it, maybe. Later in high school, I can't remember if I picked up Mere Christianity or The Four Loves first. I do recall reading The Four Loves, recognizing that something, maybe everything, was going way over my head. And so I determined to read it through with the dictionary open next to it. And that was the most I had ever gotten out of any book to that point in my life, simply by virtue of reading it patiently and carefully. Since then, I've just not really put Lewis down.
I think that's quite good advice, actually, to read it alongside a dictionary or something that's going to help you, because I think sometimes people will pick up Lewis, they'll see something they don't understand or a word that they don't know what it means, and then they'll just throw it away again. So I think that's a very sensible approach. Now, Michael, this might be quite hard to define, but in what ways do you think C.S. Lewis has impacted your life or your faith journey or some of the work that you've been doing?
Yeah, it's difficult to pin down. Lewis early on challenged me because he was so much smarter than I was, and and I found him enjoyable to read, even when, you know, I was getting the crumbs from the bottom of the table in terms of all that was there to be had. But early he challenged me, and then later he really supported me. College was a very, very trying time. That's when I really started reading a lot of Lewis. You know, I remember reading The Abolition of Man and just, whoa, needing to reread it and finding a really pathetic text there. College was challenging spiritually, particularly intellectually. I suspect that Lewis was perhaps my George MacDonald, perhaps my Beatrice in those years and the years following.
And was there a particular work of his that helped change your perspective on something or clarify something in your mind, do you think?
I can't think of a particular issue, but that's probably because of the sheer plethora of issues. He's just simply permeated my thinking and my reading. And looking back, I can see that Lewis has been a significant help to me. That's maybe the clearest and perhaps the least clear I could be on the issue right now.
and this might not be a fair question, but do you have a favorite work of C.S. Lewis?
I do. Yeah. Well, now it's Till We Have Faces. I didn't read Till We Have Faces until later in my reading relationship with Lewis. You know, in grad school, actually, at then Houston Baptist, now Houston Christian, and the first time I read it, I put it down and I looked at my wife. We were reading it out loud together, and I said, "What just happened?" What did that mean? I just got, you know, one of the final lines in the book is, "I was shot through with the arrows." I feel shot through with the arrows of something, but I've yet to identify what it is that just hit me. And so I kept reading it. I kept rereading it. I don't know how many times I've read it. I think somewhere around 36 times now. And it's a book that really does just live with me now. That is my favorite book.
Well, I want to delve into that book in greater detail very shortly. But before we do that, are there any other aspects of your work that Lewis has influenced? I know you're involved in education, but you're also interested in organic farming. Do you think Lewis has got anything to say about, I mean, clearly you have so many different interests. How does Lewis speak into all of those different aspects of your life, Michael?
Yeah. Okay. You know what? I'm going to revise one of my previous answers and say his letters. I began reading his letters. I got this volume while I was still in high school, actually. It may still have the sticker on it from McKay's used bookstore in Chattanooga. His letters, especially his correspondence with Arthur Greaves. I remember, once again, I couldn't stop reading them. I found them so thick with wisdom and wit. And he just, you know, as Michael Ward has said, he just can't write a bad sentence, and he just can't write a bad sentence. So to the question about organic agriculture and small-scale food production, he writes in a letter to Arthur, June 22nd, 1930. It's very, very close to his conversion. There is certainly something attractive about the idea of living, as far as may be, on the produce of the land about you. To see in every walk the pastures where your mutton grazed when it was sheep, the gardens where your vegetables grew, the mill where your flour was ground, and the workshop where your chairs were sawn, and to feel that bit of country actually and literally in your veins. I underlined that, and you're going to ask me later what my favorite quote is. That's one of them. So yeah, you know, in a roundabout way, Lewis has actually influenced my love of growing food and eating food and the beauty of food. You know, it's right there among the archetypes in the world that God's created.
Brilliant. And that was an outstanding impression of Michael Ward, by the way.
I've had some practice.
Well, speaking of Michael Ward, you studied a master's in cultural apologetics and worked alongside him and Dr. Holly Ordway. Would you say just a little bit about what cultural apologetics is for someone who's not clear about that?
Yeah, sure. So you could break it down into a duality. On the one hand, there's an analytical approach, and on the other hand, there's a creative approach. So apologetics, you know, fundamentally is in some way making a defense of Christianity, whether positively or negatively. Cultural apologetics either intends to analyze artifacts of culture, you know, books, an episode of The Office, or whatever, so typically some sort of art form, and sifting it for meaning, perhaps. And, you know, if Christianity is truer than all truth is God's truth, it's like a poorly knit sweater, I've heard it said before. You pull on one string and it's all connected. The whole thing comes undone. So, you know, there's this analytical approach. You can perhaps look at some artifact of literature or a film and identify certain cravings in the human spirit, some sort of craving for God, some sort of intuition of beauty or truth, perhaps some internal inconsistency with an atheistic worldview, or some sort of borrowed insight from Christianity. So, you know, there are just a variety of approaches that may be an analytical approach. And then there's a creative approach. There's simply writing good music, shooting good film, writing good books that are baked in Christianity and make Christianity feel plausible, feel beautiful, feel it's worked into the whole. And anyhow, yeah, cultural apologetics. There are lots of approaches, and there's an analytical and a creative aspect, and you'll see several applications.
I think that's quite a helpful differentiation, the two, but and they often go together as well, don't they? Which is, I guess, what you see in Lewis in quite a significant way. And speaking of Lewis, why do those teaching and studying cultural apologetics often draw so heavily on C.S. Lewis, do you think?
Well, I mean, the program at now Houston Christian really has a biographical trajectory to the course of study. You'll spend several courses on Lewis himself, because he's such an integrated person. And that's really part of this whole conversion story. Who is it? Is it Stockel? Peter J. Stockel, I think, makes the argument in his book, Reason and Imagination, that you see this trajectory in his conversion, as well as in his writing of literature, ultimately culminating in So We Have Faces, that Lewis's life is this lifelong journey of seeking to reconcile the two great hemispheres of his mind, reason and imagination. And you know, it's hard won for Lewis, but he does become just profoundly integrated. He's the author of The Abolition of Man. He's the author of That Hideous Strength. He's the author of A Grief Observed. He's the author of The Problem of Fame. So you can just kind of browse the Lewisian library and pick up a volume in the genre of your choosing, find excellent work there. And yet find, so he's diverse and yet is unified. You find many of the same ideas work out in these different genres in different ways. He's unified, he's diverse, and he is effective as an apologist, whether he's working directly or indirectly for that reason.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too. Before we get back to today's show, I want to introduce you to Christopher Gasson, who has a new book about finding God in atheist books. Christopher, what inspired you to write The Devil's Gospels?
I was running a teenage discussion group at Oxford's University Church when I decided that the best way to help them build their faith upon a rock was to tackle atheism head on. Each month we explored a different atheist book. I found two things. First, these writers, like Dawkins and Nietzsche, aren't really a threat to God. They're mainly angry about how the church has interpreted Jesus' teaching, and I think we can learn from that. Second, I found that the grown-ups in the church also really wanted better answers to atheist challenges.
So do you think we can become better Christians by reading atheist books?
That's the paradox, but I think it's very much in line with what the university church is all about. Oxford University was founded on the principle that everything that we can learn about the world will deepen our understanding of God. That's as true today as it was 900 years ago, and it applies as much to science as it does to the humanities, and indeed atheism.
So, Christopher, where can we find the book?
The Devil's Gospels is available on Amazon and in all good bookshops. Otherwise, head to thedevilsgospels.com where you can find more details.
Thank you, Christopher. And now back to today's show.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. Michael, what are some of the challenges do you think that are faced by those engaged in cultural apologetics today that Lewis may not have encountered? And do you think, and if so, how can Lewis's works offer insights into addressing some of these challenges, even though they weren't necessarily affecting him during his day?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind, which I'm really wouldn't call myself an expert on, but I identified that we have just an unprecedented capacity, especially for young people growing up right now, to live a totally artificial life, totally insulated from the real world. And therefore also totally insulated from the meaning that's baked into the natural world, right? So it's much easier to have a meaningful conversation with somebody who's touched grass, as the young people say now, you know. But for somebody who just has lived, I mean, you know, you see stuff on Twitter about like AI girlfriends and, you know, these apps that can actually produce a purely fantastic sort of second life. Having meaningful dialogue with people who have existed almost exclusively, that's hard. The evangelism now is not only the pre-evangelism of creating meaning, but even calling them out of the meaningless abyss, you know, calling them into just, you know, before trying to create Christians, we now have to try to create humans. We have to try to encourage people to just come back into the natural world, have real conversations, eat real food. That's actually part of why I think that gardening, for example, is wonderful pre-evangelism, because you're engaging with natural archetypes that are inherently meaningful. Lewis didn't have to engage with that.
Do you think there's anything that Lewis can say that would be able to help us with that, though?
Yeah. Read The Abolition of Man. Lewis is more helpful than he cannot have known how helpful he would be to us right now. Mm. The Abolition of Man seems to be the text to go to in a way that outlines just this kind of transhumanist project.
Michael, do you have a favorite quotation of C.S. Lewis?
Yeah. Again, he can't write a bad sentence. He's written, it seems like, about everything. If you read his letters, you know, you get that brilliant Lewis mind on just things. So his letters actually work as just a great companion to life. And there are certain quotes that aren't particularly, you know, it's not like they should be everyone's favorite quote, but they're lines that live with me. There are several of those from Chilliwack Basses. Among the most significant, though, may be here toward the end, just as the god of the mountain is approaching Arul. The air was growing brighter and brighter about us, as if something had set it on fire. Each breath I drew led into me new terror, joy, overpowering sweetness. I was pierced through and through with the air and so. I was being unmade. I was no one. I loved her as I would have thought it impossible to love, would have died any death for her. And yet it was not now she that really counted. Or if she counted, then oh, gloriously she did. It was for another's sake. The earth and stars and sun, all that was or will be, existed for his sake. He was coming. The most dreadful, the most beautiful, the only dread and beauty there is, was coming. I love that passage.
It's brilliant. Brilliantly read as well. Michael, obviously C.S. Lewis died over 60 years ago. Why do you think he's still relevant so long after his death?
We've touched on meaning. I think I could say three things. I think I could say it with alliteration as well. Seeing, saying, and sacramental meaning. Obviously, seeing. Lewis had a profound empathy for just the inherent quality of things. He saw things as they were, and if anything, his relevance in his readership continues to expand rather than stagnate. Holly Ordway, at the Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, answered this question by saying something along the lines of seeing and saying. He saw things and he was able to say them eloquently, which also seems to correspond to, you know, that dualism of wisdom and eloquence. You know, Lewis was wise and he was eloquent. He had the control of language, if you will. But also, I think that Lewis was deeply sacramental. I think he not only was sensitive to the quality of things, but also sensitive to that which things are pointing to. Read the end of Surprised by Joy. It's all there. You know, so what of joy? Well, joy is a signpost pointing to that which is other and outer. We don't stare at signposts. We would be at Jerusalem, right? And it's there at the end of Till We Have Faces as well. That is to say, Psyche herself was no one. Or if she counted for anything, and oh, gloriously she did, it was yet for another's sake. The only beauty that there is was coming. He who is beauty himself. He for whom the sun and the sun and the earth and the stars exist, right? So there's just this sacramental nature, the sacramentality of nature, rather, of humanity itself, of ourselves, signify God. So it's not so much sign symbolized horizontally, but sign symbolized sacramentally, pointing up. Lewis got that, and I think he's very good at training our eyes and our hearts to look other and outer.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.